is enough to make the whole world holy, enough to make all things new. I don't know if you've ever been somewhere where you felt that this place felt sacred, felt holy, felt set apart. For me, as a child, that was the fourth floor of the Museum of Natural History, where it was just covered in dinosaurs. And also Yankee Stadium. As a baseball fan, that was an important place. I don't know for you if you've felt in any of those places in your own life, you've gone somewhere where the history of that place, that seemed as almost if there were ghosts present, something deeper, richer had happened there. Also, sometimes that's a good thing, and other times it's a difficult thing, where atrocity or pain or genocide occurred. One place for me that has always been very heavy is what is called the Killing Fields in Cambodia. You'll see a picture here. In this spot, thousands upon thousands of people were brutally murdered by Pol Pot and the regime in the 1970s and 80s. I've been there 7 times, I think, each summer. I had the opportunity while in China to go down and work with some beautiful organizations were helping there. And I won't regale you with the stories of things that have happened, but as you can tell, it's a beautiful sight. It's paradoxical, this awful thing had happened, and there's a weight when you're there that you feel, but at the same time, you look around and see how beautiful nature has come and kind of grown over these atrocities. The temple in Israel, if you've been to Israel today, it no longer stands. It's where the Dome of the Rock is. But there's a sense in which something, this place was sacred. This place is sacred. There's a sense in which more to it, there's meaning beyond what you can sense or explain and you feel. And the story of the temple is a complicated one. Jesus picks it up for us in a very interesting way in the Gospels. And you'll see on another slide here, this is Rome, actually, but this is the Arch of Titus. If you've been to Rome, maybe you've seen this. This is near the Palatine Hill. This was built by Titus because Titus had destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD. And on it, you'll see in the next picture, is a depiction of the temple being looted as the Romans in 70 AD would destroy it. Taking out, you can see the lampstand there being carried off by the Romans. This was their victory over Israel, over the God of Israel. Something that Jesus is foretelling a bit as he also describes his body, but also the future of the temple. How did this happen? Josephus, the Jewish historian, explained it as, well, our God went over to the Romans, and so he sided with them on this occasion. But taking a step back a little bit, what happened? What is the temple story? Well, the story of the temple actually begins in Genesis, where God makes the world to be itself a temple. He builds it, the world, to be a place in which his presence dwells. And when you create, if you've ever been to a temple, you'll usually see at the heart of a temple an image, and a statue, an idol, usually we call them, right? And God builds the world as a place where he will dwell, his presence to be this temple in Genesis 1 and 2. And he puts in the middle of it, instead of a statue, an idol, he places his own image in you and me, to reflect God's glory, to be a representative of who God is in this place. And that follows as the unfortunately image of God is disfigured by sin. God does not give up on restoring the world to be a place in which his presence fills all things. As you'll see in the next slide, the temple is meant to be the place where heaven and earth overlap and meet. As the prophets would say, that God's love should cover the earth as water covers the sea, that all flesh shall see the knowledge of God, promises that everything would be as near to God as it was in the beginning of the garden. The entire Exodus is a story of moving from slavery to presence. It begins with the captivity of exile in Israel, where Israel is in Egypt, and it ends with the construction of the tabernacle. A people of presence of God moving into their neighborhood. The tabernacle, a precursor, a prefigurement of the temple, a movable tent in which the sacrifices and the system were created. And what follows is God through the law, through the tabernacle, through Sabbath, through all the things we read in the commandments. God is creating a sacred people, a holy people, a sacred space and making time sacred. Holy, sacralizing it, making it, like I explained earlier, a little bit like those places where we know there's something more, that all the world might know its creator and know who it is there. But the story goes awry. The tabernacle eventually becomes the temple with David's dreams, and Solomon builds it. And it's glorious and incredible. It's one of the ancient wonders of the world for people. And then in 586 BC, Babylon destroys it. Because of the compromise and sin of the Israelites, and they go to exile. And if a generation later, they return under Persia and they rebuild the temple, but it's never quite the same. The glory of it's not there. The Ark of the Covenant's not there. Ezekiel, returning from exile, prophesies there will be a temple that spans the entire length of the earth, a third temple. And so when Jesus comes on board and he approaches the temple, there is a sense in which this is not what we are supposed to be. This is not what was meant to be. This temple is, it lacks something. God's not there. Now, in between the first and between, as they were rebuilding the temple, the Greeks came along and they took over, as Greeks like to do, and they destroyed, they didn't destroy the temple like the Romans would later, so the Italians took it a step further. But the Greeks desecrated it. Antiochus Epiphanes IV went in, sacrificed a pig, and that's why the Greeks eat lamb constantly to make up for it. It's a joke, sorry. No, truly, they desecrated the holy place, and that's what Hanukkah is all about. But what I'm trying to say, and hopefully you're hearing, the history of the temple is complicated, where it is just a story after story of the temple being secularized. What do I mean by secular? It's when we move our horizon from worshiping God to basically idols, where we then begin to think that we can run our lives, we can be autonomous, we don't need anyone's help. Secularization has often been defined as a world without God, a neutral world in which I don't need anyone's help. I can invent my own story. I can invent meaning. I can choose the morals that are most valuable. They are not revealed from above, but come from beneath. And in our secular world that tries to practice a very strong separation of church and state, in which we find ourselves lacking meaning, lacking value, lacking feeling alone and isolated on how to navigate our complicated world. Now, the separation of church and state, while a good thing for institutional power, is a lie. The state just replaces the church with all its values. It deifies our public service. There is no real, like, if you understand, the sacred doesn't get displaced, it just redefined. Now, I'm not advocating for a theocracy, that we should all, you know, have the priest be in charge again, kind of thing. But what I hope you're understanding is that this is the problem that Jesus encounters. The temple has been secularized. It is not about God. God's presence isn't there. It has become a place where the aristocracy, the high priests, and the priestly leaders have used it to impoverish the people. When the temple was destroyed, in 66 to 70 AD, right before that it happened because there was a Jewish civil war. The Jews revolted against the Romans. And the first thing the Jews did when they revolted was they went to the temple and they burned all the debt records. You might not notice, all the debt of Israel was kept at the temple. The temple was the economic, political, and religious institution all in one. It was the identity of the people of Israel. And so those who were the leaders, when Jesus says, I'll tear down this temple, it is tantamount to saying, God will abandon you. And everything that has given your life and your country and your identity purpose and meaning, your economy, your politics, your value, your family life, all of it will come crumbling down. How difficult was it for some of us during COVID when we could no longer take our family vacation? Imagine having everything that has given your culture meaning stripped from you. That's what Jesus threatens, basically. And you can see why this precursor, this moment, leads in, for so many ways, for the Jewish leaders to organize his death. because he's threatening that very thing. But what's happening is that Jesus is not just angry at that the money is changing differently and there's all these systems set up at the temple that were there for money changers. What he's doing is he's visiting the place that God has seemingly not been present, and now God is present and they ignore him. God, the Holy of Holies for the first time is filled in a sense as Jesus walks upon the Temple Mount, and instead they do not recognize the hour of their visitation. It had taken 46 years to build this temple, as in the next slide will say, as Jesus would say, as he was quoting this, but he says he'll raise it in 3 days. Now the temple had actually taken about 80 years to finish by the time it's destroyed. Herod had refurbished the temple. And ironically, only 2 or 3 years after he finished it, it was destroyed again. But the temple had been secularized by Herod, by others who had used it to control the people. And my question to you today is, how do we secularize the sacred? In the next slide, you'll see that. How do we lose a sense of what's holy? How do we become secularist where we lose a sense of there's a greater purpose, there's more and meaning? Well, one, we fail to recognize God's presence. We can be practical atheists. So the question I like to ask youth, so if you're here and you're younger, how would your life be any different if you didn't go to church, if you weren't a Christian? If there's not much of an answer, then I would have to ask, well, are you practically an atheist who just can check a few beliefs off on a box? You can be, as some would say, a deist. You know, God is far away, there's a creator and all that. I believe that, but it doesn't impact my daily life and it won't change anything of how I would live. That's a question I have to ask myself regularly. Does this faith in which I practice and the God whom I love have an impact on the routines and daily life that I live? We lose the sacred when we denigrate the common. In the book of Acts, Peter is given a vision of a bunch of different animals that he's supposed to eat, and he says, I won't eat these, Lord. I have kept kosher my whole life. I will not eat anything common or unclean. And at the end of this story, Jesus says to him in the vision, do not call anything common or unclean. It's easy to reject the image of God in others, to, in our treatment of one another, denigrate God's presence by not acknowledging the dignity and humanity of each person. There is no disposable person in the world. There is no one who we can just throw away, and we live in a throwaway culture. That's another one. We are wasteful. One thing that has really struck me about being Anglican is we take our bread and wine here and we don't throw it away. I have to consume it, or we give it to the earth, but it's not garbage. It's special, it's reverence, it's sacred, and the thing I love about that is if I cannot distinguish the reverence, you know, treat bread with reverence where I believe Jesus is present to me here, how can I treat you? If I cannot treat something so simple as this with reverence, how can I not treat my neighbor? And it's particularly the neighbor I don't like, or the neighbor who I feel uncomfortable with, or the one who I avoid on the street, or the one who I know dislikes me, who would avoid me in this room if they could. So when you come up today, remember, if this is a place to start practicing hospitality, God welcomes you. Welcome one another. So instead of secularizing the sacred with our lives, treating one another, treating our community, treating the world, treating our bodies, treating this place as if there is nothing more, I encourage you today in Lent to sacralize the secular. Jesus said to the woman at the well that there would be a time where they would worship not on this mountain or that mountain, but they would worship the Father in spirit and in truth. Paul would tell us that do not know your body as a temple of the Holy Spirit. The church itself is the continuation of Christ on earth. It is where we encounter God and God encounters us. Peter would tell us that we are living stones, a body built up as a spiritual house. As N.T. Wright would put it, Those in whom the Spirit comes to live are God's new temple. They are individually and corporately places where heaven and earth meet. That is our hope and prayer today, that this is a place where heaven and earth meet, where all of the secular things of our lives, the everyday minutiae, the mundane things we have to do, they are impinged upon by the holy, by the transcendent, by the more, by God himself. We come together and we don't do something routine and mundane. We do something very special, even in the common. And to make this a bit maybe more practical, it might sound a bit abstract. How do we sacralize our lives? How do we make sure that we do not become like the aristocracy who are just going through the motions of the temple and God's not present in our lives and going through these cycles? Well, the Ten Commandments offer us a path. The Decalogue, the 10 words God spoke. They are not laws and rules to condemn your life. So as a child, you hear these laws, and it's easy to be like, well, these are all how Christianity is a wet blanket, just telling you what not to do, and this is all for your good, but it's like, you know, eating vitamins or, you know, eating spinach, and you just, you know, have to do it, but the law is given to a people to set them free. The Torah is a place in which God sanctifies us to make sacred people, sacred space, and sacred time. The first three commandments are about worship, about idols, about who we center our lives around. And the fourth commandment, if you were paying attention, was the longest commandment. It's the Sabbath, about setting space and time sacred, about this is our world, about a world in which is sacred, a way in which we treat our planet, our communities, our land. And then the last six are primarily justice, how we treat one another, how we live in community. They point to the cross. The cross is a compass for navigating the commandments in a way in which we are to embody worship and loving God, loving our neighbor. And they go in that order on purpose, because if we try to do justice without love, without worship properly, we will create injustice. Now, it's important to memorize them, but what I encourage you to think about here is how the cross of Jesus makes each of these commandments real to us. How God in the cross destroys every idol. How God takes the temple itself, which had become itself an idol, and instead his own body takes upon the punishment and the pain and the suffering and brings freedom. It is the cross that brings us out of the bondage of Egypt, metaphorically. Think about how the cross sets a way in which we now view the world around us, how we will love one another and how we will treat one another. We are not autonomous people. We are not left to ourselves to make it work and figure it out. Instead, the commandments themselves are a pillar. They are a way to set us free, not to enslave us, not to make us miserable. So to tie it all together a little bit for you, maybe. This next slide is in Hiroshima. I had the privilege to visit that difficult place a few years ago. Here in the middle of the Peace Park is where the atom bomb was dropped. And there now, where you'll see in the back, the dome still left of a hospital that had been destroyed, is left as a memorial. But here there's a centigraph, a statue, a monument of that peace. And a bit like Cambodia, here is a place which some of the most horrible human invention, the suffering and pain has been demonstrated, has become a memorial of peace. And on that stone, it says in Japanese, never again. Another image. This is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This is the site of Christ's crucifixion. Now it looks, it's a church, it looks flat, and when you walk in, it feels flat. It's, you feel like you're on the surface, it's been, ancient city's been built up, but Jesus was crucified on a hill, a garbage dump, where trash was thrown away, Golgotha. Today, it's a little different, it's been spruced up. And that's exactly what it means when we take the secular of our world and we allow God to dwell with us. He takes what is most ugly, what is most evil, he takes it all upon the cross, and it takes that ugliness and returns to it beauty. The commandments that we are called to follow are not to shortchange our lives, they are to prepare us for beauty, to make things new, to set us free. And to you today, I encourage you to know that if you are struggling and your life feels disfigured and brutalized, if you find yourself feeling abandoned and alone, as if your own temple has been desecrated, God takes that, he destroys it and raises it anew. And so that the worst parts of your life, your worst mistakes, your worst failures, the worst consequences of life lived in the hands of Jesus, who's been crucified and risen, become a beautiful memorial of God's grace. And most importantly, know that God dwells with us. Whether it's a magnificent room like this, or whether it's a garbage dump on the side of the road, God makes all things holy. I say all this in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Give us a moment to reflect on this, and if there's anything you want to share and pray to the Lord, I encourage you to lift up from any of the readings or time together in worship.